Modern English Version of the Bible by Robert C. Newman. Brief abstract. With a large variety of Bible versions now in print, how are we to evaluate which ones are reliable? A series of criteria are suggested. These are applied to the King James Version, where it is noted that these criteria were satisfied when the version was made in 1611, but are not satisfied any longer due to changes in the English language, and to additional evidence regarding the text of the Bible that was unknown at that time. Some theological developments since 1611 are also sketched, and the criteria proposed are applied to some recent versions. Problem stated. We have a very large number of Bible versions in English today, with new ones coming out nearly every year. How do we tell which ones are reliable for the use of Christians and seekers in trying to understand God's message to mankind? Well, we suggest these criteria for evaluating a translation. First, are the translators in agreement with the teachings of the Bible? It is not a good thing to have hostile translators translating a document. Secondly, is a translation faithful to the best available text of the Bible in the original languages? Thirdly, is the translation clear for its intended audience? Fourth, does the translation conform to good contemporary English usage? And fifth, does the translation have stylistic beauty? Let's think about the Authorized or King James Version, published in 1611. This was a committee translation with three committees appointed by King James I and meeting at Westminster, Oxford, and Cambridge. It involved the best scholars in England at a time when biblical scholarship was at its peak. All the committee members had a very high opinion of the Bible. Thus, the King James Version seems to have satisfied all five items when it was translated. But with a passage of almost 400 years, it no longer satisfies all these criteria. How's that? The King James Version no longer conforms to the best available texts in the original language. The King James Version is no longer in contemporary English. The original audience of the King James Version is long dead. And none of this is the fault of the original translators. Changes in English since 1611. Well, there have been verb changes, pronoun changes, vocabulary changes. Verb changes. One of the noticeable changes is the disappearance of the EST forms for second person singular. Thou comest, you come. Thou knowest, you know. Transformation of the ETH forms for third person singular. He knoweth changes to he knows. Pronoun changes. Disappearance of the distinctive second-person singular forms thou, thee, and thy. These were not terms of respect when the King James Version were made, although many people in modern times have understood them though that way. It's not respectful to speak to God as you instead of thou, etc. These were not terms of respect when the King James Version was made. Disappearance of the second plural ye. This was replaced by the second singular plural form, you and your, which does introduce a certain amount of ambiguity into English, but there's no way to get rid of all ambiguity. Replacement of the relative pronoun which by who when a person is referred to. Verb and pronoun changes. None of these changes are likely to produce serious misunderstanding of the text. They do give the average person the impression either that the Bible was written in some sort of pious or stilted language, which it was not, or that its light writers were illiterate, when in fact the translators were more literate than most of us are. Far more important are the vocabulary changes, as these actually hinder understanding. What kind of vocabulary changes? Some words in the King James Version are archaic or no longer used in modern English. Assuage, as in Job 16:5. Ensue, as in 1 Peter 3:11. Holpen, as in Psalm 83:8. Rereward, as in Numbers 10:25. Straightway, as in Matthew 4:22. Twain, very frequent, in various places in the Bible. Wat, as in Genesis 21:26. Those who have read King James Version from earlier years probably have some idea what these mean, or particularly when put back into their context. Those who don't. Other words are changing meaning. Charity, in 1 Corinthians 13, charity was just a street synonym for love when the translators originally made this translation, but now it has very much picked up the connotation of donations to people who or organizations for purpose of helping others. Fetch a compass. Today, fetch is perhaps a little on the archaic side or regional side, but we would think a term like that would mean to go get a compass from somewhere, whereas it has something to do with turning. 2 Samuel 5:23. Girdle is often used in the Bible, and whereas in antiquity, whereas in older English, that meant a belt, basically a synonym for belt. It came to have reference to a particular form of a woman's undergarment in later years. Huh? Leasing, Psalm 4:2, now meaning renting something, but earlier not. Meat, often used in the Bible here and there, was basically a synonym for food, whereas that now is a particular term for a particular type of protein. Prevent, Psalm 119, 147, 148, means in modern English to stop something from happening, whereas in ancient and older English it means to precede, to go before. Rent, often in the Bible, now means to what allow somebody the use of something for by paying a fee, by the person paying a fee, but then meant to rip or tear. Tire, Isaiah 3:18, with the development of the automobile age, has to do with the type of structure used on the wheels of automobiles. Back when this translation was made by the King James translators, it meant what we would call attire or clothing. Well, those are examples of vocabulary changes. The Bible was originally written in common everyday English. It was intended to be understood by average people. So we need to make a revision or new translation as often as the language changes significantly. Because we want to preserve God's intention, we want to make his message plain. So that much for vocabulary changes, grammar changes, etc. Textual discoveries and developments since 1611. I want to talk a little about the textual basis of the King James Version, about some manuscript discoveries since 1611, about developments in textual study. Textual basis of the King James Version, the New Testament text of the King James Version is ultimately based on the edition of the Greek New Testament by Erasmus in 1516. Erasmus' edition was based on only a few manuscripts, and the oldest one he had, 10th century, was actually the least used. Erasmus had only one manuscript of Revelation, and that was incomplete, and so he supplied the last six verses of Revelation from Latin, translating it back into Greek. Acts 9:6 and 1 John 5:7-8 were also supplied from the Latin. Manuscript discoveries. In 1611, very few manuscripts were known from before about AD 1000. Since then, several hundred earlier manuscripts on parchment have been found, with two nearly complete from before AD 400. Since 1900, many fragmentary New Testament manuscripts have been found written on more fragile papyrus and copied before AD 400. These include substantial parts of several manuscripts from before AD 200 and a small fragment of John from about AD 130. So we've got a good bit of manuscript information that we did not have when the King James Version was prepared. Developments in textual study. The known manuscripts are now seen to fall into several families, of which the most important are the Alexandrian, the Western, and the Byzantine Alexandrian are those manuscripts which depend upon textual developments in the area of Upper Egypt, that is, in Lower Egypt, Northern Egypt, Western, on textual developments in Italy and North Africa, and Byzantine on textual developments around Byzantium, modern Constantinople. The Alexandrian family is an early text family that was known to be in existence by AD 150. It's rather short, but seems to be reliable by the kind of tests that can be made centuries after the event. This is the text used in most recent English versions. The Western text is also early and was known to be in existence by AD 150. It's longer, somewhat erratic, has a tendency towards additions. The Byzantine is a later text, probably not in existence before AD 300, not to say that some readings of it were not. It is of intermediate length and often seems to combine the Alexandrian and the Western readings. It looks like it was perhaps an attempt to compromise between the two rather divergent sets of readings that exist in the Alexandrian and Western families. This Byzantine text is a text used in the King James Version, by and large. Some differences. Matthew 6:13b, the doxology of the Lord's Prayer, does not apparently show up in the text in the New Testament before the 3rd or 4th century. Mark 16:9-20 is one of the long passages, so there's only a couple of them, where there's any dispute of this sort. It is perhaps the most controversial one. It is known to have existed before AD 150. John 7:53-8:11 is the other long passage, the woman caught in adultery, not in the earlier manuscripts. Probably a real incident preserved outside the New Testament. John, 1 John 5:7-8, passage on the heavenly witnesses. There are three that bear witness in heaven, the Father, the Word, the Spirit, etc., these three, the one. Is not in Greek before the late medieval period. It does appear in Latin, however, but does not appear to be in Latin before the 5th century. So, there those particular things related to the text of the New Testament and the general consensus that has developed. There is dispute over it yet. Is that the Alexandrian family tends to be the strongest of the three families there. Some theological trends since 1611. Well, the Renaissance was going on from about 1300 to around 1600, so in the period leading up to the writing of the King James Version, the translation of King James Version, it is characterized by a revival of interest in the classical period, the period of Greco-Roman history that surrounds the time of Jesus. The Renaissance is also characterized by a weakened dominance of the church, which had been pretty dominant during the medieval period, say from 800 to 1200, something of that sort. The Renaissance reintroduced many pagan ideas. Another feature that was going on right while the King James was being made is the Reformation, which we may date as lasting from about 1500 to about 1700. I return to Scripture as the sole authority in faith by those who were the Reformers or Protestants over against the Roman Catholic emphasis on Scripture and tradition and authority of the Church. The Reformation also tended to emphasize the priesthood of believers, which then led to more variety interpreting. The Catholic approach had been that the scriptures were too complex for believers in general to handle, and we need to bend upon specialists, but also upon the united voice of the church, so a traditional interpretation of various passages. Where the Reformation came to dominate, the occultism of the Renaissance was suppressed. Some other theological trends since 1611, the rise of liberalism from about 1700 to the present. Liberalism is basically characterized by a reaction against the supernatural, anti-supernatural reaction, a tendency for science or reason to replace authority of church and Bible, rejection of miracles, liberalism begins to enter the German churches in the 1800s and begins to enter the U.S. in the 1900s. What's the present situation today? Well, liberalism is still strong in academia. There's been some resurgence of orthodoxy in the past several decades. There's a growing diversity in ethnic groups in our country particularly, and influence from other religions then into the U.S., Eastern religions and such, and the development of the New Age movement. So, how do these things affect us as well? Well, that brings us to the question of evaluating translations. We suggest these criteria for evaluating translations. Are the translators in agreement with the teachings of the Bible? Is the translation faithful to the best available text of the Bible in the original languages? Is the translation clear for its intended audience? Does the translation conform to good contemporary English usage? Does the translation have stylistic beauty? Well, are the translators in agreement with the teachings of the Bible? I would suggest that the New American Standard, both in its old and updated forms, the New International Version, the New Living Translation, English Standard Version, etc., those are examples of translations in which the translators are in agreement with the teachings of the Bible. Those that fail seem to me to be the New Revised Standard Version, the Revised English Bible and its predecessor, the New English Bible, and the New World Translator. The first two of these, committees are dominated by people who have rejected certain significant teachings of the Bible. They belong to the category we call theological liberals, some more moderate, some more radical. The New World Translation is a house translation of the Jehovah's Witnesses who reject the deity of Christ. We need to discuss the whole question of the deity of Christ, and we do some things in that direction in some of our other PowerPoints here. But we suggest that those kind of translations fail. There are lots of other translations out there in some form of pass and fail, some form of fail area, etc. Is a translation available, faithful to the best available text of the Bible in the original languages? Well, most modern versions pass that. Ones that fail are those that have refused to go in the direction of the what I would understand to be the best available text of the Bible now available today, and that would be the King James Version, the New King James, and others that have rejected the Alexandrian family and going with Byzantine or Textus Receptus or something of that sort. Is a translation clear for its intended audience? Well, of course, not all these Bibles have the same intended audience. Typically, Bibles try to aim at a very broad audience, so very substantial overlap. The New Living Translation is probably among the ones we've mentioned here the easiest reading. Okay, it's designed to be easy to read. Okay, the New American Standard Updated and the King James Version are probably the hardest reading, aimed at a higher level of education for the readers. Does the translation conform to good contemporary English usage? Most modern versions pass in that particular direction. They were designed to do that. Ones that fail, older versions, where the contemporary English for which they were designed has changed substantially. For somewhat different reasons, it seems to be the New American Standard Bible and the Amplified Bible fail in this regard. The New American Standard Bible was so concerned to preserve the details of the Greek and Hebrew of the New Testament, Old Testament, that it often sounds rather wooden in English. And the Amplified Bible sought to preserve various alternative translations in such a way as to badly disrupt the flow of the reading of the Bible. Not a good Bible for reading. It might be a Bible of some value for study, although even there, I tend to use a rather wooden sort of way of giving every possible meaning to words where in a particular context some of those would be ruled out. Does the translation have stylistic beauty? My own thinking here, and people are going to disagree with this, I think that the New International Version and English Standard Version are the best of our modern ones, that the New American Standard updated and that the New King James Version are somewhat weak in the area of stylistic beauty. What about the whole question of literal versions versus paraphrased versions? Well, here's a nice chart that I found somewhere that helps this some. The arrow on the left side, literal, and on the right side, interpretive. And the author here has put on the major and a number of the minor versions that existed when the chart was made up. So an interlinear would be way over on the left end. And then you would have the New American Standard Bible and the King James over towards that left end, the New King James a little less over towards that end, the New American Bible Catholic Version still further over, New RSV still further over, Amplified and NIV and Jerusalem Bibles about in the middle, and then the Good News Translation and the Children's Version and the New Living Translation moving over towards the right, the Living still further over, and Peterson's The Message over near the extreme right end of interpretive or paraphrastic, if you like. Some tests for theological soundness. I suggest these criteria. These are only a sampling of what could be a much longer list. Some tests for theological soundness. Do the translators think the apostles properly understood the Old Testament? If you have them translating Peter's speech in Acts, where he's citing the Old Testament in a way that's inconsistent with how they've translated the Old Testament, you get the idea that they do not think the apostles properly understood the Old Testament. So, Peter, compare Acts 2:27 with Psalm 16:10. Matthew, do they think Matthew understood? Compare Matthew 1:23 with Isaiah 7:14. Well, Peter, Acts 2:27, question of whether he understands the passage in Psalm 16 as that Jesus would not decay, and Psalm 16 is often translated by translators who don't think the apostles properly understood the Old Testament as saying that he would not see the pit or something of that sort. Matthew, the question of the virgin birth of Jesus, a virgin will conceive, and then some of your translators translate Isaiah 7:14 as a young woman will conceive. Hebrews, compare Hebrews 1:8 with Psalm 45:6. It certainly sounds like in Hebrews 1:8 that the writer understands that the psalmist is calling the Messiah God. Has that been handled in some way by the translators of Psalm 45 to evaporate that? A second criterion, do the translators think the apostles believed Jesus was God? Well, John, check John 1:1 and John 8:58. By the way, that will generally go okay in liberal translations, because liberal translators don't believe that the Gospel of John was written by an apostle, and they do believe that the Gospel of John was written by somebody who believed Jesus was God in some strong sense. On the other hand, the Jehovah's Witnesses, who believe that the Gospel of John is God's word, but who do not believe Jesus is God, translate John 1:1 and 8:58 in a way to avoid the deity of Jesus. Paul, check Romans 9:5, where it appears from the Greek that Jesus is seen to be God by Paul there, but translators have often taken an alternative to avoid that if they don't think that Paul believed Jesus was God. Hebrews, check Hebrews 1:8. Does the author believe Jesus is God? Further tests. Do the translators downplay messianic prophecy? Theological liberalism believes that people can speculate about the future and say things, but that they're not going to be right very often. So how do they handle Psalm 2:12? Kiss the Son. You will see lots of divergence there to avoid what seems to be a picture of the Messiah as son. Psalm 22:16, do they picture the Messiah with pierced hands and feet? Isaiah 9:6, do they translate in such a way that the name suggests deity for this person in Isaiah 9:6? Isaiah 53:10-12, does the Messiah die and live again? Daniel 9:24-25, is this the Messiah or just an anointed one? Micah 5:2, is this person eternally pre-existing? Zechariah 12:10, does the passage say, look on me whom they have pierced, God himself speaking as being pierced by his by the Israelites, etc. Those are samples of that. Do the translators downplay resurrection in the Old Testament? 1 Samuel 2:6, Job 19:25-27, Psalm 17:15, Psalm 49:14-15. Well, that's the end of our rather brief talk here. My prayer is, Lord, help us to judge rightly.